Well, with the state fair canceled for this year, we are missing our annual dose of North Carolina traditions. And could there be anything more North Carolina than NASCAR-themed pig racing? We're going to do our best to bring you the sights and sounds of the fair. Can't do the smells, but there you go. That's the Hogway Speedway, a staple of the state fair. Brent Cook is the owner and announcer for the touring show, and he joins me now. Hello, Brent.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing very well. How long has it been since you had a summer vacation? You travel with this thing, right?
Yes, sir. This is probably the first time I've had a summer vacation over 20 years.
You and your dad have a touring show, right? Each of you has your own. And folks who know the Hogway Speedway from the State Fair probably remember your dad as well. But you were one of the first ones on the microphone to give it a kind of an analysis, right? Tell us how you decided to, first of all, follow on in the family business and expand it in a way.
Yes, sir. My parents brought me up in 4-H. I was in 4-H when I was 4 years old and from many years up to middle school. And then we started our first pig racing company, and I was the announcer for the first unit, and then it just grew from there, and my dad started his unit, and then my mom, so it's just a family business that we travel up and down the East Coast with.
And you actually kind of started as a petting zoo, right, and it evolved from there, am I right about that?
Yes, sir. We started as petting zoo and pony rides. We had friends and family wanting us to bring animals out to their local birthday parties and festivals, and we had the animals, so we said, why not start a racing pig company?
And we call it pigs, but we should clarify, you're not just racing pigs, right? You got all sorts of critters running around that track. Tell us about that.
Yes, that's right. Other than pigs, we had pygmy goats that race, and also Indian runner ducks, and also the potbelly pig. So they would just race a variety of animals around the track each and every show.
Is there a training process for this?
There sure is. We have a practice track that we leave at the farm set up throughout the year. And once we have the litter of pigs born and they're weaned, ready to start training, I'm working with them once or twice a day for up to a couple weeks till they're ready to hit the road.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, how do you train these animals to know where to go?
Well, the biggest thing, pigs, the animals are very intelligent anyway, but our animals are trained to race for a treat. They know when they cross the finish line, they're racing for cheese doodles. So that is totally the prize they get when they cross the finish line.
Cheese doodles. Yeah, cheese doodles,
yes,
is all it takes. This is great.
Yes, that's it.
You've got to build a brand, of course. You went for NASCAR to kind of theme this thing. So tell us a little bit about, you know, whether this thing, because you travel all over the country, right? So does the theme track well all across the country? NASCAR?
You know, the theme does. Of course, you know, NASCAR, I always say, I was born and raised in North Carolina, but we travel from Wisconsin to Florida, and we take our NASCAR up north, and we name our pigs after NASCAR drivers like Hammy Hamlin, Hamica Patrick, Piggy Gordon, and so on. So we just have fun with the NASCAR theme.
Now, do these animals keep their names? I mean, is Piggy Gordon the same pig from year to year, or do you change names?
We do change names. Like, we used to do Piggy Gordon, he retired. Now, next year, Lord willing, you know, Dale Earnhardt Jr. has retired also. We had Earnhardt Jr. So we try to keep new NASCAR names, keep them fresh each year.
What are you doing with your time off this year?
Well, spending a whole lot of time with my family. I'm married and have 3 little boys, ages 7, 5, and 2. And it's just great to be at home to have fun with them while I'm not on the road this year.
And just very briefly, how have the traditions changed? You've been doing this for a while. Have state fairs changed much over the years?
It has, but, you know, it gets better each year. And that's one thing I'm missing, being at the state fair this year, because each and every year we get to see a lot of friends and family, and we just have so much fun working the state fair each and every year.
Brent Cook, the owner and announcer for the Hogway Speedway Racing Pigs. Brent, thank you so much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
And we're going to continue our tour of the state fair this year. Stay with us as we talk to a cattle shower, a turkey leg chef, and a basket maker. That and more ahead on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. State Fair was canceled, and at precisely a time when we could use that annual booster shot of North Carolina culture. Now, the fair is a celebration of rural life in the capital city. The annual festivities date back to 1853, when around 900,000 people lived in the state of North Carolina. Last year, that number plus some took the trip to Raleigh to fill up on fried food and see the sights. Obviously, a wise choice to keep the fairgrounds crowd-free this year. But since the festivities have a role in boosting our collective morale, we decided to feature some of the memories of the State Fair on today's show. You can chime in on Twitter with the hashtag NCStateFair. Love to hear from you. Joining me now is Franklin County Livestock and Beekeeping Agent Martha Mobley, also the owner of Meadow Lane Farm and a board member of the Durham Farmers Market. Hello, Martha.
Hello, Frank. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. You have been heading to the fair, I know, since a very early age to show cattle. Apparently you weren't there just for the funnel cakes. You had work to do. Talk about what it takes to prepare a cow for competition.
Oh, it takes maybe a year or so because you need to get the right genetics to have that calf that's the competitive. And normally the older we were involved and longer we were involved, and a lot of times with our 4-H'ers, longer they're involved, we want that competitive animal. So we would mainly search out for the right genetics, the right breeds, and even had to breed artificially, Frank, that animal so that it would be competitive at the state fair. So it would normally be a year and a half, 2 years in advance if we were going. But a lot of these farmers in the area would go, and my father would do the same thing, and I would do the same thing, try to find that animal in the spring of the year and then wean it from their mother and then bring it up to a corral and a pasture area around the farm and then start with the halter breaking process.
Well, competitive, let me interrupt you there, but competitive how? What are you looking for? What are the judges looking for?
It varies. It's trends that are set every year, Frank, and I can go over the hairstyles from back in the 70s with the cattle.
Wait a minute, you got to stop you. Hairstyles?
Hairstyles. That we groomed them a certain way. We had to trim the hair a certain way. We could use adhesives and glues, and I think they have stopped using those now. So it's been a lot of trends, but we had to have the right genetics, and then we would have to tame that calf down and then start working with it, leading it in June or July so it would trust us, and then get ready for that track to the state fair.
Now, I'm stuck on the hairstyles. Is blow dryers involved in any of this? Or
very powerful blow dryers, Frank.
My goodness.
Very powerful clippers.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of my 4-H'ers loved it so much that they became professional dog groomers and I'm glad now they're making more money than I am, I think, being a professional dog groomer. But they loved the doing the hair and the grooming with the animals.
Yeah, I wish I had a chance to ask the calf how it felt, but let's move on because it's not just grooming, right? It's musculature. What are some of the other things along the way through the years?
The structure of the animal, it had to be structurally correct. It had to have the certain muscular frame size, thickness, disposition, which is heritable. That was had to be just right. You didn't want an animal to blow up inside of the state fair ring when it was being shown. So there's a lot of different components that you would be involved to find in just that right animal, that super animal that you could take to the state fair.
Now, after you aged out of 4-H, you started passing along lessons to the next generation. I wonder what's different about young folks' interest in agriculture these days. What are you seeing?
I still see a lot of interest, Frank. Even children from the city or the towns that don't have an animal, but they would call and say, please connect me with the club leader. Or before we had club leaders in this county, I was sort of the club leader or my parents. And then they would want to come to the farm, and we made sure every child that wanted to show an animal at either our regional shows or our state fairs had an animal to show. So it was a lot of opportunity there for our children.
I was interested to see that in the evolution of the state fair and how it grew, particularly in the middle of this century, with agriculture secretaries in the state and governors who were very interested in seeing the development of the state fair. One of the things they connected pretty quickly was that entertainment and education and a little bit of competition could go a long way in advancing, you know, some of the causes of agriculture. So when you're looking for just the right animal, as you said, and then you show it and it wins, is there any correlation between the winning animal and, you know, sort of better development of breeds? Is it just a state fair animal and then you go back to actually breeding cows that people care about?
Right. We did. A lot of those animals have traits that we do want to bring back for our average beef cattle farm or dairy farm or whatever type of livestock farm. So they do have traits that we can bring back, but we also try to teach the farmers about having production also and carcass traits that are very key, such as on my family farm and others. And then having a child, you know, a lot of these farmers had crops and then they had a few cattle. But if I could get their children involved with showing livestock, especially at the state fair, then that was one way I could reach that farmer and say, farmer, let's get a new bull. Let's get a new herd sire. Let's improve your genetics. And they would listen, and they would buy that new bull and really start improving their farm's genetics. And that was done through their child participating in 4-H.
You know, one of the big things that's changed over time, certainly as the state fair grew, as we say, in the middle of the 19th century, industrial agriculture was center stage when we talked about farming techniques, and those were the techniques that were being promoted. Since then, we've seen a lot of attention paid to more sustainable techniques. Certainly, you do that at your farm and others at the Durham Farmers Market, et cetera. Has that emphasis changed at all in the fair, do you think?
I think so. You know, they're getting that cattle now instead of what they were back in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. We were getting the animals so tall and so trendy. A lot of the bloodlines from the Kia Nia breed were brought in. I had just a semen tank full of the top genetics that I would bring in just for show animals. So I think now, Frank, they are bringing the animals down to a moderate size, with good better carcass traits, and thinking about what's the meat quality and not just the product, not just the structure quality. So I think they have improved. It is more sustainable. But these animals that do go to competition are on grain. They're fleshy. They are conditioned. Well, that means normally using heavy grain, where a lot of our other conventional and sustainable or grass, using forages to keep those farms sustainable.
So let me ask you this. Once you're done showing, and I'll take you back to maybe your days when you were showing and a little beyond, what do you do then? What do you like to do at the fair when you're not showing?
Oh, because, you know, my late husband Steve ran the horse shows at the state fair. So we would probably meet up. We'd call and say, okay, we've got 30 minutes before a show starts. Let's meet in the horticultural building and go look at tour the flowers and the gardens and something relaxing and get out in those gardens and see the new varieties of flowers and that kind of thing. That's what we would love. Or either we would meet up for a gyro somewhere halfway. We would love those gyros and just to get out and meet one another and just to relax for a few minutes.
If you enter the fair through gate number 8, over by the pond and across the road from the horse stables, there is an essential stop for every fair goer, the old grist mill.
Well, the awful hush puppies, because you would not believe the people that come through there out of state. I guess we use it as a lure in the beginning to get people, hey, let's go down and get a hush puppy and go through the mill. And then when they get inside, a lot of people say, wow. We go back to the old water-powered way of how mills were run in the 1800s, 1700s, you know, and the stone ground, the stones actually turn into plexiglass where you can see the corn going in the stone and the product coming out. It's just a great display of stone ground corn mill started. You know, a lot of people have never seen anything stone ground. You know,
that's Darrell Spencer, the man behind the old grist mill and the free hush puppy that so many enjoy every year. I'd like to welcome another fan of the State Fair to the show. Lee D. Baker is a professor of sociology, cultural anthropology, and African and African American studies at Duke University. Welcome back, Lee.
Hey, Frank. Good to be back.
It's good to have you. Let's talk a little bit more about some of the traditions that you and your family do every year at the fair, or did every year when we had it, and I guess it'll be back next year, we think. Talk about the things you like to do.
Well, we annually go to the fair, and having the turkey legs and the chicken, I mean, and the corn is an annual tradition for us. We also like to go to the old hall. I can't remember what it is, the town of yesteryear. My wife is a big quilter, and she takes us there and goes over each quilt and describes it for us, and it's usually just a great time. I mean, for me, the fair is always just a celebration of family, fun, food, and farming, and it's just a great way to bring the whole state together.
It's a lot of, as you say, family, fun, and food. When you think about farming and agriculture, it's probably one of the most grounded activities we can think of. And yet the bizarre and the weird is also an essential part of the fair. Lee, how do you think these things come together at the fair and have more or less remained so popular?
Well, it is interesting. Because in Europe, in England in particular, the fairs were very highbrow. They were just showing animals. And in America, where it was much more trying to lure the masses, if you will, the carnival aspect came in the 1870s and the 1890s. And so you had much more of the fun piece along with the education and the exhibits of the modern farming, for example. And but with the carnivals always comes some of the more sketchy sides of American history, from freak shows to the fun and games that in some respects institutionalized dehumanization. There was this game called the African Dodger, where people would actually throw balls at black people as fun. So it did a lot of that work. And so there's some challenging history with fairs, but it is part of our history.
Well, we're going to talk more about that, too, because I think that is an interesting side. But Martha, I want to hear from you, too, about the fact that rural life is also celebrated here, but it's celebrated in the state capital. I mean, talk about the significance of celebrating rural life in the city of Raleigh.
It was so important for us, and we were so excited and still are excited to make that trek to Raleigh, and then to have the citizens and the public come by and sit down and ask us questions, meet the 4-H'ers showing there, maybe even touch an animal. That was many years ago, but they would sit down and we would have a greeting area in our display that people could pick up a piece of candy, talk about raising animals. And they came back to our booths, our displays there, Frank, in the Jim Graham building year after year. And that was part of their fair experience, is coming to see the Franklin County 4-H livestock cattle display. So that was important for us, and that's why I tried to get a display right there at the door. One for ventilation for the cattle that were bedded down there in the barn, but also that we can meet and greet and educate the public about seeing and knowing where their food comes from and meeting these future farmers.
Well, trades and crafts are certainly an important part of the fair, as you both have suggested. If you continue our tour of the fair, if you continue up the road from the grist mill, you got a choice. You can turn right and you could get some warm apple cider and watch the blacksmithing, or you could hang a left at the belt-driven ice cream stand and head into the village of yesteryear, where you might meet Mr. Neil Thomas, and he will tell you how he makes his split oak baskets.
Well, the first thing I do, I go down in the woods and find me a tree and cut it down and bring it back to the house, and then I take my axe and wages and stuff and bust it up in little small pieces like this right here. And then I got a drawing horse and a draw knife to the house. I draws it down the widths I want it, you know, and then I splits it all out, and then I soak it, and then I put it together.
That's Neil Thomas, a split oak basket maker, exhibiting his craft in the Village of Yesteryear at the North Carolina State Fair, which is canceled for this year, apart from some of the foodways, which we'll talk about in just a bit. But Lee Baker, you mentioned the other side of the history. I mean, the fact is that the state fair was segregated for a long time. I mean, talk about the racial history of this and how race does play a part. And we can't ignore that in our discussion of state fairs in North Carolina. Lee?
These fairs are just, you know, exercising values and parts of society. And for many years, not only were cows shown, but during the eugenics movement, they would have exhibits of quite literally sitter families, and it would be showcasing what the typical white family should look like. And these are just parts of our history, and I think it's important to sort of recognize it, but also, I think more importantly, to recognize how today all of North Carolina comes together and celebrates the agriculture as well as the fun and the food.
Yeah, it's one of the few times when rural folks and city folks can actually get together. And again, as we see, you know, one of the great divisions in America is this rural-urban divide. It's been going on for a while and seems to be getting worse. So what the fair does one way or another is at least in that moment and in that space bring people together. Martha Mobley, let's talk about some of the other ways in which things have changed. Many of North Carolina's farms now rely on the labor of Latinos. How do you think the state fair, how do you think it could do a better job, perhaps, of celebrating their role in our rural economy?
You know, that's what I've been thinking. And when I was reviewing to get ready for this show, I did talk to the organizers of the livestock shows, Frank, at the state fair. And I said, that is one of my goals. My remaining goal in my life is to have a support these Latino children that want to come out. They don't have the animals, but let them come out and form a club to add. We just need to add more diversity with our Latinos and let them go. But I would always take a day off at the fair and take my Latinos that run my farm. You know, I could not farm without my dependable workforce that are very devoted. And we would have the best time going through the fair and seeing the giant pumpkins and the apple displays and all the produce and going to the way they would barn tobacco, like what I grew up barning tobacco with the stick barns. So that is one thing that, you know, we are getting more Latinos, I think, that are coming through the fair. But it's one of my personal goals is to get them more involved with our livestock clubs. And that's something that I can do.
Lee Baker, what do you think about the future of fairs after all of this? They perhaps will be back next year. What's it going to look like in the future, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't thought much about it, but I think I just hope we can all come together because it is such a celebration of North Carolina and bringing rural folks and urban folks together. I think it'd be a shame if it somehow we had to stay 6 feet apart and that'd be impossible there on the Midway, that's for sure, and as well as throughout. I'm sure things are going to have to change, but hopefully we can hold on to what's good about the fair.
Lee D. Baker is a professor of cultural anthropology, sociology, and African and African American studies at Duke University. Martha Mobley is an extension agent in Franklin County, and you can see her farm's giant pumpkin at the Durham Farmers Market on October 31st. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, we're going to continue our tour of the state fair by talking with some of the chefs behind the food we wait for every year. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, continuing our tour of the North Carolina Fair, which is canceled this year. Apart from the food, there is, you know, real culinary talent that you need to get that funnel cake, for instance, out of the fryer without breaking. The chefs that offer the decadence prepare for the fair for weeks. This year, things will look a little different, but you can still head to the fairgrounds to get your fix of 22 local vendors who will be there from October 15th through the 25th. Then you can bring some cans of food to the food bank. It's going to be set up nearby on October 22nd. But more than just fried food, of course, massive statewide cooking competition goes on at the state fair. And I'm joined now by a sophomore at Bunn High School who won 9 blue ribbons at the culinary and bees and honey categories last year. Lance Williams, welcome to the State of Things.
Hello.
Good to have you here. You've got apparently a spectacular pound cake that has been a consistent winner for you over the years. So let's ask you about that. Do you make a traditional, because you make it with no leavening agent, right?
Yes, I have 2 recipes of pound cakes. One of them is called a true pound cake, which has no leavening agents and is made just like your great-grandmother would have made it. And I also have a mock pound cake, which does have leavening agents in it.
All right. So give us a clue. I mean, you may not want to let us in on all of your secrets, but what does it take? Give us some sense of what it takes to make a great pound cake.
When that true pound cake, of course, with there being no leavening agents, the real key and trick to making a good pound cake is getting out your stand mixer and making sure it's whipped just the right amount. You don't want to under whip it or over whip it.
You whip it all together, or do you have to get the eggs whipped first to get them stiff?
Yep, you have to really make sure you're getting them all together. You use a mix of both egg yolks and full eggs to really get that good rich flavor and thickness to your cake.
All right, that's enough for now. I'll try to figure out the rest on my own. That and just lots of butter, I suppose. But I'll let you go on that. You've been competing through your 4-H. How long have you been involved?
Well, I've been entering stuff in the state fair since I was in the first grade, and I joined my 4-H at the countywide level when I was in second grade.
Well, what were your first entries? Do you remember?
Oh, it's so long ago, I can't barely remember, but it was probably just something simple like chocolate chip cookies. I remember my mom sitting me down saying, "We're going to try out these recipes." And since then, I've just absolutely loved baking.
Well, that sounds great. And so when you're not showing at the fair, then what do you like to do when you're at the fair?
When I'm at the fair, I always go for 2, maybe 3 days of the fair. On one of the days, I'll get those wristbands, and I just ride as many rides as I can. I really enjoy those. And then on the second day, I slow down a little bit, and we have a family day. And one of my favorite things to do is walk around the garden, sit on a bench, and just watch the people.
Do you ever eat any of the food while you're there, or do you save your appetite for leftovers?
Well, I'm personally not a huge fan of some of the crazy foods, but every year I do usually get a classic like a a funnel cake.
Have you thought about deep fried pound cake? They must have done that by now, right?
You could
slice it, batter dip it, and then fry it, and then add a little bacon gravy or something. I don't know. I'm just thinking for next year. I'm just trying to give you some ideas. Do you create your own recipes? How far back do your recipes go? Are they like old family secrets, or do you try to come up with your own creations? How do you work now? Because you've been at it for so long, as you say, it's hard for you to remember when you were in second grade because you're already in high school. Tell me if you're innovating at all in your recipes.
I must admit, a lot of my recipes just come out of recipe books and looking online. But I'll try them out one time, taste them, see what I like about them, add a little bit of this, take away a little bit of this, and before long, I don't even need a recipe sometimes on my pound cakes because I'm just whipping them out of the oven.
Sounds great. When the competition's over, there's all these like leftovers. Do you all sit around and share each other's leftovers? How does that go when it's over?
Well, I must admit, I'm not bribing the judges, but I usually take some of the leftovers from cooking and give it to some of the judges because, like the cakes, you only need to bring half a cake or half a batch of cookies. Mm-hmm. So I love sharing it with all the people that make the fair happen.
How many do you have? Like, do you do like 9 of them and then take the best? Or, you know, you look and say, no, that's not good enough. You have to do 2 or 3 more. Or do you pretty much bake one and take it to the fair?
We have had some mishaps dropping cakes in the oven and all, but typically I've done this for quite a long time, so I can usually get it down pat in one go.
I'm talking to Lance Williams, a 16-year-old champion baker from Franklin County, and I am now joined by one of the vendors who you can catch at the fairgrounds next week for your fried food fix, Mike Neal, the owner of Hickory Tree Turkey Barbecue. His stuffed turkey leg won the 2019 People's Choice Award for Best New Food at the fair. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Frank. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. What did you stuff that turkey leg with?
We stuffed the turkey leg with our crack and cheese, which is essentially some homemade mac and cheese, some smoked hickory smoked turkey barbecue, fried turkey cracklings, and our signature sauce.
It's too bad you had only a turkey leg, the whole carcass. With that stuffing, I would think you just need a bigger cavity. Now, you've been going to the fair for some time now. Have you missed any over the years?
You know what? I grew up going to the fair, so it was always like a really good time for us. I missed a few years. I took a job out in Memphis, Tennessee. Missed a couple years, but for the most part, I just love the state fair.
Memphis, absolutely. What a waste of, they don't know anything about barbecue. You got to come back to North Carolina if you want to stay with
absolutely. Absolutely. I was in Memphis bragging on North Carolina barbecue. In fact, this was actually before I got in the business of making turkey barbecue for the public. I had a chance to compete with some of the guys in Memphis in May, which was a lot of fun. But little did I know at the time that was a prelude, because just after, you know, our stint in Memphis, came back to North Carolina, and that's how Hickory Tree Turkey Barbecue came about.
That's interesting. So what led to that then?
Well, essentially, my background is engineering, so I took a job out in Memphis, and my wife and I, we were born and bred in North Carolina. And so while I really enjoyed the work that I was doing in Memphis, my wife was like, I'm really missing home. And so we made the decision to move back to North Carolina. And so I started visiting all of my old barbecue places because I really missed North Carolina barbecue. And I was talking to a gentleman who was ready to kind of get out of business, and I was trying to encourage him to keep it going. And little did I know that I had an opportunity to run a barbecue joint.
This is perfect. A guy moves from Memphis, and the first thing he does is eat barbecue back in North Carolina because he actually misses real barbecue, and in the process then develops his own business, turkey barbecue. So at the North Carolina State Fair, and I know legs are traditional, but I feel like, you know, maybe you're fighting an uphill battle when you're trying to sell turkey barbecue in the pork state. How does that go for you?
Absolutely. So in North Carolina, it's all about pork. So when, you know, back like many years ago, when we had family gatherings, we would always put like the whole hog. That's how we barbecued. It was the whole hog. But my great grandmother started having some health issues and so forth. And so we would always kind of slide her turkey on like a turkey. Started out with a turkey breast and then it went to a turkey. She's like, I'm really missing my barbecue, though. So we started preparing the turkeys as if we were preparing the hog and mixing it up, Eastern North Carolina style barbecue. So she enjoyed it. And pretty soon people just started enjoying the turkey barbecue. And that's how we started really doing turkey barbecue. Again, that was way before I had even started going to college and so forth.
So I'm guessing if that was a tradition in your family, there are probably a lot of families who are barbecuing turkeys, who are smoking turkeys and making that part of the fair. It probably was not that unusual for a long time for families to be eating that, right? In some ways,
right.
It's just not pork. Lance, let me ask you, if you're, and you do a lot of baking, obviously, and you're extremely successful at it. Do you show any interest in cooking? Do you like to do this sort of thing when we're talking about barbecue and barbecue recipes?
I really love cooking just as much as baking. And actually, one of my loves of cooking came from Miss Martha Mobley's camp one year when we went to local farms and learned about different meats. And we got fresh pork and brought it back and made pork chops. And that was just a great memory.
Mike, how did you learn? You talked about the fact that you were in engineering. You'd moved to Memphis, came back, and you liked to eat it. How did you actually learn the techniques and the craft of barbecue?
Well, I learned at a very early age. And so my folks, they would have these gatherings, if you will, where the guys would go out and put a hog on a pit. And so I essentially started doing kind of menial tasks. Going out, just grabbing certain things, mixing up, you know, some sauces or whatever, just very menial tasks as it related to cooking the whole hog and also serving like just people in the community and so forth. And so I kind of picked up little, you know, parts and tricks of the trade understanding like proper heat and so forth until I got to the point where I was preparing a hog myself. And then, yeah, I kind of took that away. And even though I started working out in corporate America and so forth, I would always kind of, you know, and anytime I wanted to kind of decompress a little bit, I tell my wife, I think I'm going to put a little something on the smoker. And before I know it, she has invited 50 people over, right? And so that was, again, it was a hobby at the time. But as long as I had my space, you know, I'm more of an introvert. She's probably the most extroverted person that I know. As long as I had my space and doing my barbecuing and smelling the hickory smoke, everything was all good with me.
But a real show of confidence, the fact that she would invite, maybe it's social on the one hand, but she's got to know it's going to turn out right to invite all those people. So that's pretty cool, too. What does it take, though, Mike, to get to gear up for the fair when you go in terms of getting your gear and ingredients ready? Because you have to do it on location, right?
Right. So we do a lot of stuff on location. So it's really essentially moving an operation, an entire cooking operation from Greensboro to Raleigh for the state fair. So it involves like refrigerated trailers. It involves prepping equipment, just making sure we have proper fuel. It's a big undertaking. A lot of planning goes into place for pulling off that at the state fair.
You talked about doing this all your life and growing up with the food all around you, so it wasn't that big a stretch when you actually moved into the business. Do you think there is a kind of a North Carolina, you know, touch and kind of a North Carolina taste that you bring to the food, or that you know, you have to think about when you are preparing your barbecue?
So for me, it's all second nature. You know, as I said, whenever you talk about barbecue in North Carolina, it's all about the pork. A lot of people don't realize, though, North Carolina is the second largest turkey producer in the United States. And so while, you know, other regions, like when I was in Memphis, I couldn't just go to a barbecue shop or anything and ask for barbecue, because they'll look and say, barbecue what? You want barbecue beef? You want barbecue pork? You want barbecue bologna? You know, so it was a lot of like just, but in North Carolina, if you ask for barbecue, you know, you're going to know what you're getting. But I incorporate just my upbringing, again, being kind of North Carolina born and bred, into like all of my recipes. So my ingredients are all pretty much from North Carolina. Another popular thing that we have is what I call a soul roll. And it's essentially collard greens and mac and cheese wrapped inside of an egg roll. And so, you know, the collards and everything, that's pretty much in North Carolina. So we bring the taste of North Carolina with us as we serve.
Lance, let me ask you, as a young chef and a craftsman from Franklin County, do you think it's important for folks in the cities to understand the skill and traditions in rural areas, the kind of thing that you would bring to the state fair?
I think it is very important, because I feel like every day the divide between urban and rural areas is just getting really big. But the North Carolina State Fair is a time where we can really showcase what we have in common and where North Carolina's roots are in the rural area. So I think it is very important and good that urban people can know what it's like in rural areas.
Let me ask you what you're planning. You're in high school now. Is food a part of your future, do you think? Professionally, what are you planning to do? Or have you not crossed that line yet, that threshold yet?
I absolutely love cooking, and I will never give it up, but I don't think I really want a career in cooking. It's more of a hobby and some fun for me to do after school and after doing things.
Mike, you were talking about the fact that turkey production is huge in North Carolina, along with hog production and local ingredients. I think it's one of the more interesting things about our state, the variety of agricultural products that you can get here year round. It seems to me is one of the most striking things about the state. Not that the pork is great and the turkeys are great and the collards and all that. It's that all of it grows here, and you know, as sweet, not to mention sweet potatoes. How important is that to you, to have sort of local ingredients as part of what you do?
I mean, it's very important. I mean, the local ingredients, you know, food is a time. We were talking about, you know, the fair being an opportunity for city and, you know, rural areas to come together. I mean, food is one of those things that bring people together. So I think it's important that the food represents the region that you're particularly in, because that, you know, whenever I travel, I try to go and get some of that local food, because for me, that's the essence of an area.
I know, but the thing about living and moving to North Carolina that wrecked travel for me, one of the things I would always want to do, you go on vacation, you want to try the food, till I moved to North Carolina, then I'd go on vacation and couldn't wait to get home. So that's the unfortunate.
Exactly right.
That's the downside of living in North Carolina. Mike Neely, owner of Hickory Tree Turkey Barbecue. Mike, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
Lance Williams is a sophomore at Bunn High School and a 9-time Blue Ribbon winner at the 2019 North Carolina State Fair. Lance, so good to talk with you. Good luck. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to know what you can eat and have not had quite enough, we're talking about food. But if you want to taste it, you can head to the fairgrounds October 15th through the 25th to get your fix and find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.